Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 30th day of July 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another installment of the French Connection. Of course, lots of things have been going on in the world, more financial problems, more. It's often not very good news that we're getting, ladies and gentlemen. It's building over the summertime, and this is, you know, the news doldrum period for the world. And it seems to me that this is a good time for the crooks to try to slip in a lot of the legislations and a lot of the criminal activities they need to get under the radar of people. So it's time for us to be more diligent than usual, because this is the time they do that. A couple of corrections I'd like to make. My last interview with Tex Mars, he used the word Serranos when he should have used the word Moranos. And, of course, everyone knows the Murano Jews are the ones that were transferred over during the time of Columbus and then thereafter, and found themselves in the southwest of the United States, setting themselves up as very powerful brokers. They're still there. Many of them are what we call crypto Jews. They live there sometimes as Christians, sometimes as undeclared, but they're often Jews under the surface. They have names like Lopez and others. And another correction I'd like to make, and it pertains to the guest I have today. He mentioned that I worked on the book of Synagogue of Satan. I didn't work on the book Synagogue of Satan. I worked on the timeline with my guest today, in fact, so we're going to have a chance to talk to Andrew once again, but I thought I'd clear that up as well. The actual things that I did with Andrew were helping him publish, and he got a lot of his original information from the things I was publishing on the Rothschild family, and it actually helped Andrew get started on much of what he was able to do with his book as a subsequent project. So I don't want to take credit for the book part of it, although the timeline part of it was a kind of a joint effort between Andrew and myself when he was just getting underway, and I can take credit for inspiring him to get going on the project, which is something I'm very proud of, and it's a great thing to see that. Another thing that I want to straighten out was a scripture error that somebody pointed out to me, which it's not that important to me, in fact, but to some people it is. It's the Saint Stephen death coming at the hands of someone. And anyway, it was given a little bit incorrectly, so I thought I'd mention that as well. Try to keep up on some of these things. One other thing that I gave out as misinformation, and it was not intentional, was the Catherine de' Medici information being the wife of Charlemagne. That's not true. She was the wife of Henry II, which was a couple of hundred years after Charlemagne. So that's an important thing. But what was true was that she did bring with her many of her connections to the Jewish gold traders of Florence and of Venice of that day. So there I was absolutely spot on with that information, and also the information saying that much of the investment money from Florence flowed into Paris, which Paris at the time was still a very underdeveloped city, and that money flow from Florence was largely in the hands of Jewish bankers. We also note at that time in history, the Spanish had already kicked out many of their Jews under the Spanish Inquisition, and they found their way into Paris as well. So what you had is a convergence of a lot of Jewish forces into Paris in that time period. So, and Catherine de Medici was instrumental in getting a lot of Jewish business people and Jewish financiers into Paris at that time, which gave birth to the kings of France becoming very flush with money. We're going to find out, ladies and gentlemen, that there have been a lot of times that Europeans have kicked Jewish people out of Europe. But we're going to, before we get into that, I'm going to invite my guest on to the air here. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Darrell. Nice to be doing the show with you again.
Well, it is great to have you here with us again, and it's always important to clear up small errors that we make, you know, because they often are made without intent. And I actually knew that Tex was making a couple of small mistakes the other day, and you know, some of the people have asked me why I had Tex on at all, because he has this relationship what's his name?
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones. Yeah, sorry, I don't even like speaking his name, but it brings on the Hooby Joobies with me over here. But and I mean Joobies, ladies and gentlemen, because you know he seems to be working overtime now to say the New World Order, Bilderbergs, blah blah blah, and he's absolutely 100% avoiding criminal Jewish Zionism, and he's saying, you know, of course, the founders of the Masonic system and everything were not Jews, or he's not pointing to them as being the Grand Orient Lodge controllers. And we know, Andrew, that that's not true. We know the Grand Orient Lodge was usurped entirely by a Kabbalistic Zionist criminal Jews, don't we?
Well, yes, and that's a topic that we'll get on to today in this installment. And also, I'd like to point out for the listeners that I've had a similar situation with Tex Mars. When he offered to publish the book, I sent him a promotional copy, and he is well aware, as is his publisher, I deal with Moore, who works for him, of my views on Alex Jones. But it's one of those things that it's a difficult thing to call. He does have a lot of good information. I don't like the association there. I've made my feelings clear on that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I printed 500 books. He's sold thousands of them. So he's got the word out on this, which has got no Alex Jones influence on it.
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, I can piggyback into some of the evangelical Christians, too, because there are a huge block of people out there who have really been lied to the most, and they need the biggest education is needed in that group. So Tex has inroads into that, and I don't fault him. You know, one of the things he said to me privately was, look, I don't want to get into food fights with anybody, and I think that's a little bit of a cop-out, but at the same time, he's not afraid to point the finger at the Zionist Jews, and I will take that if I can. I mean, look, you know, we need all the allies we can here. I'm often finding myself battling this thing alone, Andrew.
Yeah, and I think also with Tex, of course, in America, the huge Christianity thing is the Judeo-Christianity, and the fact that he has so many people that support him and support his ministry, just to sort of see the size of the scope of what they do, and they have their show every week, and they do all sorts of other things as well. I applaud the people that do support him, because they've taken that step away from Judeo-Christianity.
That's right, because actually Judaism and Christianity are absolutely opposed to one another, as far as my research has shown me. There's another thing I wanted to bring up here. I've been getting some mail from a few people, actually three only, but that's a few, about Adolf Hitler and financing of his war machine through Jewish money. Now, I've got absolute clear evidence that the Jewish bankers were involved in the 1930s funneling large sums of money into Hitler's Germany to build factories and to actually forgive certain debt that he had. We also know that American Federal Reserve money was ponied up for his war machine early 30s. So the fact of the matter is that there are some clear relationships between Adolf Hitler's and the Zionists. And, you know, so I don't know all of the connections, and nor does anybody, but many of them have been proven. Some of them, you know, are less clear. One of them being that, you know, he bulldozed a Jewish cemetery with a couple of Hitlers buried in it. That is anecdotal. I don't have proof of that. There's no smoking gun evidence. And, you know, the Schlick and Gruber connection to Rothschild is only circumstantial, although it does point to some clear connections if you want to believe it. But when you add the totality of evidence together with things we can prove, like the transfer agreement, like the Zionist coin that had the Hitler SWAT sticker on one side and the Star of David on the other, these things can't be denied. And, you know, the fact that his SS was very top-heavy with Jews, these kinds of things are not deniable, Andrew.
No, and I mean also that there's a couple of problems here. I mean, there are going to be people in this movement who will look up to Hitler because they'll see him as the last person who really tried to take the money power on, because he did actually create a real economic revolution in Germany. And I think that people try to look for heroes in this movement. I mean, even last time I raised Andrew Jackson up, and of course there was the slavery angle that I'd overlook, which you corrected, and I'm pleased you mentioned that.
Well, actually, it was the American Indians that he slaughtered them wholesale.
He slaughtered
Cherokee. Terrible.
Yes. So, and the trouble is, in life, like anything, you're not going to find a clear-cut individual. And the situation surrounding Hitler, I mean, I remember one of your Eustace Mullins shows in which Eustace Mullins believed that Hitler was actually replaced by a double shortly actually before World War II. He was effectively taken out. And I'm sure I heard that on one of the files that Eustace Mullins did.
Yeah.
I don't know if you recall that. If you don't recall it, it might have been a Eustace Mullins show with somebody else. But I've got a feeling here. I definitely heard him on one show. And the thing is, there are certain elements, and it's very difficult because I've always maintained that if the information that we can get out in the public is as great as we can get, what's really going on behind the scenes that they are covering up, and things like that. So I think that the best thing to do is to do our best to get hold of the information that we can, try and put that together to bring up a coherent argument as to who's doing what and why, and follow the money. And I think if you follow the money, that's the real key.
Well, that's right. And I.B. Farben is a clear example of following the money. And we know I.B. Farben's factories were running all the way till 1945. And they were absolutely controlled by Jewish money, 100%. So in that regard, we don't need to argue. And why would it be that a Jewish-owned factory is pumping out armaments? And, of course, they avoided bombing it. There would be destruction all around the I.B. Farben area where they were working, and yet the plant would remain unscathed. So a little bit more than coincidence there. But that being said, we're going to get right into this, Andrew. We're finishing the book. There's actually a bit of a sadness in me for this, because these visits that we have on a semi-regular basis are going to change here, and I'm a little sad by that. But here it is. We're starting with the very beginning of the book. We've worked our way back to the start here, and so we're going to start with 1649, which probably is the saddest day in British history. If you want to really look at the entire totality of British history, huh?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about 1649 is this is where we've got Cromwell getting the backing from the British Parliament for the execution of King Charles I. But the interesting thing is here is that from 1290, I believe it was Edward I in 1290, he actually expelled all the Jews forever from England and made the provision that any who remained after November the 1st of that year were going to be executed. Now, the interesting thing was Cromwell tried to overturn that in the Parliament and could not do so. And so what he did instead was something we see a lot of leaders do today, like, for example, you know, with immigration into different... I think there's arguments, isn't there, in America about the Mexican border, for example. And so they say, oh, yes, to come into America, you have to, you know, have a green card or whatever. But they just don't enforce the border, and so anybody can get in. And that's essentially what was done here. The law was that they weren't to enter the country, but Cromwell said, well, I'm going to let them in anyway, and there was nothing that anyone could do about it. And the interesting thing was, you could see there that it was actually that they were the people that were actually backing Cromwell, which is why, you know, only about 50 years later, or less than 50 years later, 45 years later, we're going to get the first... a second central bank, essentially, where Bank of Amsterdam was first, would be set up in England.
Well, that's a very sad day. I got a question for you, Andrew. Do you know how many countries in the world the Irish have been banned from?
No, I don't.
Nor do I. How about, have you ever heard of the Swedes being banned from any place?
I don't think I've heard of any race being banned from any countries now.
Except
for... Well, apart from in Israel, I think that you have to be a Jewish to buy land there.
Well, but here we go for 1,000 years here in the book. How many countries have the Jews been banned from?
Well, we've got over 100, I believe.
Yeah. One of the things I always learned is that if you point the finger at everybody else around you, like, you know, it's you. Maybe it's not them. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's yourself. The Jews are always saying that it's everybody is racist. Could it be that every country in the world that kicked them out are all racists, or were they onto something?
Well, the thing is, I mean, we've got an author here, Bernard Lazar. And he's a Jewish author, and he had his own feelings on this subject, and what he said was, if this hostility, even aversion, had only been shown towards the Jews at one period and in one country, it would be easy to unravel the limited causes of this anger. But this race has been, on the contrary, an object of hatred to all the peoples among whom it has established itself. It must therefore, since the enemies of the Jews belong to the most diverse races, since they lived in the countries most distant from each other, since they were ruled by different laws, governed by opposite principles, since they had neither the same morals nor the same customs, since they were animated by unlike dispositions which did not permit them to judge of anything in the same way, it must be therefore that the general cause of anti-Semitism has always resided in Israel itself and not in those who have fought against Israel. And this is a Jewish author who states that. In 1894,
he was spot on. And let's go to the next thing here. It says Professor Jesse H. Holmes, writing in the American Hebrew, expressing the following similar statements. It says it can hardly be an accident that antagonism directed against the Jews is to be found pretty much everywhere in the world where Jews and non-Jews are associated. And there, as the Jews are the common element of the situation, it would seem probable on the face of it that the cause will be found in them rather than in the widely varying groups which feel the antagonism. So, again, what we find here is hundreds of countries over the last millennium have expelled Jews for behavior uncitizen-like, immoral, unkind, criminal, usury. Pick your poison. And here's Cromwell... In his decision in 1649 to open the floodgates. So let's go back here now and move ourselves forward to 1688. What is A.N. Field in his book All These Things published in 1931? What does he talk about here about Cromwell?
Well, he's talking about the situation regarding Cromwell's decision to ignore the law banning Jews from entering England. What he said is, 33 years after Cromwell had let the Jews into Britain, a Dutch prince arrived from Amsterdam surrounded by a whole swarm of Jews from that Jewish financial centre. That was the first central bank we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Driving his royal father-in-law out of the kingdom, he graciously consented to ascend the throne of Britain. A very natural result following on this event was the inauguration of the national debt by the establishment 6 years later of the Bank of England for the purpose of lending money to the crown. Britain had paid her way as she went until the Jew arrived.
Well, you know, what we've got here is, you know, one of the things that history tells us is that many of these Jews that were found their way into Amsterdam actually came out of Spain when they were ejected. The ejection from Spain was mass and complete, and many of them not only went to Paris, as I described in the intro here, but a lot of them went to Holland, and they used that as a jumping off point to many other places, including the United States. Is that correct?
It is, though. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why we see people like Aaron Lopez finding his way to Newport, Rhode Island, and becoming the main slave broker in the United States, using his connections to both Britain and Holland, and his knowledge of sea lanes and freighting of using ocean-going vessels to make himself one of the richest men in American history on the backs of slavery and the black population. So that's a little addendum there. But, of course, William III, who came in from us, William of Orange, is it not?
It is, yes.
And is it not the same use of the orange men in Northern Ireland, the same thing coming from William of Orange?
I think that the orange men in Ireland, I think that they're sort of misguided because they, William of Orange went against the Catholics and they don't like the Catholics, they're the Protestants, and so they actually get behind William of Orange and they ignore the Jewish connection there. They see him as a sort of Protestant hero.
So isn't it time for us to possibly set the record straight for Northern Ireland and let them start looking into the real history of William?
Well, exactly. But it's one of those things that even if that was changed, there's been so much bloodshed between them since, between, you know, the IRA and the UVF, and they've all sort of been blowing each other up, that the sort of truce that they have now is not really. It just means that the attacks that still go on are... kind of covered up by the media, surprise, surprise. And also, they tend, what the IRA kind of developed into and the UVF and what I've looked into was they were essentially a criminal organisation hiding behind a religion, and your drug trade and what have you was being controlled out of, they were kind of fighting over that.
Yeah. Well, we also know that the MI5 was up to their eyeballs in both groups.
Oh, yes.
Well, let's move on here to 1698. The Bank of England had been already well ensconced for several years, but what you write here is that they really took a leadership control over the economy, didn't they?
Yeah, and this is a very important point that I wanted to get across to the listenership, because this is a demonstration of how and why control of a nation's money is so important and a central bank is so important. Because what they do, they've been in charge for 4 years of the Bank of England, and they just literally overloaded the British money supply. The way that they do that, it started off, the British money supply was £1,250 million, and it went up to £60 million in this 4 years, which is an increase of 1,280%. And we need to explain why they do this. But I'll give an example here. If the money in circulation in a country is £5 million, so the whole money of a country is £5 million, mm-hmm. and a central bank is set up and prints another £15 million, this is stage one of the plan, and they send out that £15 million into the economy through loans, etc., then that will reduce the value of the initial £5 million, which was all the wealth of that country that was in circulation before the bank was formed.
Yep.
This is because the initial £5 million that was 100% of the economy is now only 25% of the economy, because you add that to the £15 million they put out there, and that's 25%.
Yep.
It therefore gives the bank control of 75% of the money in circulation, with the £15 million they sent out into the economy. This causes inflation, which is basically the reduction in the worth of money due to the economy being flooded with too much money.
Yep.
And so if the bank were able to print money out of nothing, then the money that the people were using just to exchange goods and services becomes worth less and less, and these people are kind of just taking more of that all the time. The public then have to borrow money because they can't afford it, and then that's when the banks tighten the money supply, when they've got a lot of it and they tighten it, and people start going into bankruptcies, and then the bank can go out and they can claim real wealth, like the farms and the land and the property, from the people who were quite happy before they arrived, and now suddenly they find themselves all debt slaves to the bank, or worse, they have nothing and the bank owns everything.
Yeah, this is the boom-bust cycle they've created through debt creation, and we're entering into a period of this. This in a worldwide way. We're going worldwide with this criminal theft, and it's time for everybody to wake up to it. But let's go on here. This is interesting. We skip ahead a little bit here. 1744, Meyer Amstel Bauer. Now, one thing you didn't put in here, and you probably know it today, that Bauer actually worked for Oppenheimer in Hamburg, did he not?
He did, yes.
So what we have is the progenitor of the Rothschild fortune was actually Oppenheimer, who today actually works for Rothschild.
Well, yes, and but I would still say I think that all these families are kind of a linked network, and whether there's a particular person actually in charge, you know, we could say the Schiff family, they are the Rothschild family. You know, they married in so early on that they are essentially the same family.
Well, Al Gore's family married into the Schiff family too, so he must have links right to the Rothschilds.
Well, yes, and I think it goes back again to, I think it was the previous broadcast when we, what we'll get onto in this one is about the promotion of interbreeding within this family. And if you think of what they started with over 200 years ago, the amount of children that were sired then, how that could have grown in leaps and bounds across the world.
Oh, man. You know, I read this stuff and my head spins. I can't even... it makes you want to be sick. Now, this woman, Gertl Schoppner. Now, is the Schoppner family still prevalent in this? And she was the matriarch of the Rothschild / Bauer family.
Yes, she was. I haven't really come across that name again. I did do a bit of research into that, but that only seemed to pop up that one time.
Hmm.
But it'd certainly be interesting if any of the listeners have any knowledge of that.
Well, that would be interesting, yeah. So we get on here now with, during the decade, it says, of Meyer Amstel Bauer's work for the bank owned by Oppenheimer in Hanover. Hanover, Germany is what I said. I said, I didn't say that. I said,
I think you said Frankfurt.
I said Hamburg.
Oh, yeah, sorry,
okay.
Yeah.
He was highly successful and became a junior partner. Whilst working at the bank, he became acquainted with General von Ersthoff. Now, who is he?
General von Ersthoff is a guy that basically is the guy who got him in with the royalty in Germany.
Yeah.
And it's important to note the acquaintance there, because he may have found another way in, but this was his way in to royalty. And of course, as soon as you start getting acquainted with them, with your money lending activities, soon you're lending money to finance wars, etc., etc.,
yeah,
as opposed to lending money to people coming in and out of your bank or your counting house, as it was called in those days.
Well, he slithered on into Prince William of Hesse Hanau, one of the richest royal houses in Europe. That was not Germany then, it was Prussia, was it not?
I believe so. I think on that side. I think we're basically looking at the borders there. But I think around that time, we're certainly getting towards the formation of Germany anyway.
Yeah, Prussia was a... kind of a fractured, several different rich princes and rich areas there, and they kind of married themselves together later on to become what Germany is today. But okay, so what we go on here now to say is that that's in 1769, now the Rothschild name has been used. Meyer Amstel Rothschild starts lending money to this Prince William. And the grandson of King George II of England, cousin to George III, nephew to King of Denmark. So what do we get here? He lends this money, so what does Rothschild do when he gets the money in there?
Well, Rothschild's basically lending the money to Prince William, and he actually puts a sign on his building declaring that he is M.A. Rothschild by appointment, called factor to His Serene Highness Prince William of Hanover. And now what he goes on with this Prince William, which we touch on again later, but he ends up hiring out armies to other countries, like military forces as such, and we touch on that later. Here we are. Back in 1806, when Napoleon says that it's his object to remove the House of Hesse-Cassel from rulership and strike it out of the list of powers. And at this stage, this is where, with the deals that have been going on now for over 30 years between Rothschild and this Prince William, Prince William will hand over $3 million to Mayor Amstel Rothschild, $3 million to Mayor Amstel Rothschild for safekeeping. And this money, is never returned. And we go to 1814, where the Jewish Encyclopedia 1905 edition says, according to legend, this money was hidden in wine casks and escaping the search of Napoleon's soldiers when they entered Frankfurt, was restored intact in the same casks in 1814, when the elector, Prince William, returned to the electorate, then now Germany. The facts are somewhat less romantic and more businesslike. And I just put the remark that the last line indicates the money was never returned by Rothschild to Prince William. And the encyclopedia goes on to state that Nathan Mayer Rothschild invested this $3 million in gold from the East India Company, knowing that it would be needed for Wellington's Peninsula campaign. So we can jump back now to where we were. But it's difficult this early stage of the book because we kind of hop about a bit.
And I
just wanted to jump forward.
Well, we need to pull the threads so that people get the full story instead of the kind of the fractured. But we go 1770. He comes up with the Illuminati plan, and this is when he starts doing deals with Adam Weishaupt, is it not? A crypto Jew, it says, yeah.
Yeah, this is the interesting part about the Illuminati. Adam Weishaupt, crypto Jew. He pretends he's a Roman Catholic. The Illuminati is based on the teachings of the Talmud. And basically, what happens here is the plans are drawn up in 1770. In 1776, Weishaupt officially completes the organization on May the 1st, which is why we have this May Day that a lot of people say is Communist Day, etc., etc. And what he did, and you touched on earlier in the show about Freemasonry, the first plan was really to infiltrate the Continental Order of Freemasons with this doctrine and establish lodges of the Grand Orient to be their secret headquarters.
Yep.
And this basically spread into the Masonic lodges throughout the world. And we go on to talk about how he recruited 2,000 paid followers, which were got from intelligent people in arts, letters, education, science, finance, and industry.
Yep.
And they were instructed to follow various methods to control people. One of them was to use monetary and sex bribery to blackmail members of government. The second one was to get hold of look out for students at colleges and universities who were exceptionally intelligent and belonged to well-bred families and try and convert them to their ways. The third one was all the influential people that were coming under the control of the Illuminati and the students were to be put behind the scenes of governments as experts and specialists, direct governments, in order to get the long-range plans of the Illuminati followed by.
Well, this is where our arch nemesis Alex Jones does not make the connection between Talmudic Judaism and the Illuminati. He's always saying the Luciferian controllers and all this other nonsense. And instead of saying that this is a this was born and raised within the Jewish community, and now what we also know too, Andrew, is that the New Bohemians were also a group started from the Illuminati, and the New Bohemians were Sabbateans who loved to have these yearly orgies with each other, and they actually were immigrated into the United States. One family that we were able to dig up some information on was a Bush family, a Solomon Bush, that was a New Bohemian. And you know, when you hear this, oh, he's a Bohemian. Today it's taken on the tenor of a avant-garde kind of libertine, but it's not as negative a connotation. But the fact of the matter is, these were filthy perverts that were running around the earth from the Jewish community, and they got themselves ensconced in many parts of the United States as well. Is that not true?
Yes, I mean, it goes back to what one of the first quotes that we said, where this Jewish author, Bernard Lazar, made the point that, you know, the morals of these people don't match with the morals of nations that they enter, and that's why they are removed.
Well, you know, we know that that there's some truth here to the matzo ball and childhood murders and what the rest of it there at their Passover feasts, we know that there's been enough court action within that to bring some truth to that claim. Let's go on now to 1771. Of course, it mentions again, it mentions Jeanette Rothschild. Now, Jeanette Rothschild is born in Germany, of course, and she goes on to marry who?
Benedict Moses Worms, which I think, you know, we've got the Wormses now, haven't we, in the world? And,
yeah, we do.
Again, this is another name that hasn't cropped up too often, but we get most of the daughters here, but you don't get, in all the things that I was looking, and I looked in various different, you know, all over the place, trying to find a link up to these, where the daughters went, because I think that that's really the missing key, and I think that a lot of these high-profile families today will come out of there. There was a Fritz Springmeier book called Bloodlines of the Illuminati, which I read, and he'd done a lot of research into this, and he never came up with a lot for the daughters.
Well, he
studied it in such a great depth. So, and there were other people who wrote about it as well, and it's very difficult to map. My feeling is that certainly some of them ended up in America very early on. And you've got the sort of a lot of these high-profile American families, and I think that this is where we've got the Rockefeller connection would go as far back as to one of these daughters.
Or even Vanderbilt, or even Bush,
yeah.
Or even
exactly.
Al Gore's family, or even... And many of these people, you already see the propensity to lie about their Jewish roots and claim Christian roots. And you'll also find a lot of these crypto-Jews claiming Episcopalian roots in their religious beliefs. So the Episcopal Church has housed and covered up for a lot of crypto-Zionist Jews. So here we go. Now, 1774, Solomon Meyer Rothschild is born. And then we get on to, again to 1776, which, oddly enough, is the birth of the United States, but that's when Adam Weishaupt officially completes the organization. Does he go on to do anything else? Oh, you already went into that a little bit. I guess we'll go...
Yeah, the only point I missed was the fourth point, which is point four, where the other thing that they needed to do was to obtain absolute control of the press. So back as far as... 1776, they realized that control of the media was, you know, a factor as big enough as blackmailing government officials, brainwashing young students, putting those young students into government positions. So they knew the areas that they needed to control over 200 years ago.
So we move on to a couple of births here, and I'll give those in a quick order here. We've got the birth of Nathan Meyer Rothschild in 1777. In 1781, we have the Isabella Rothschild, who we should try to find out who she married. And then we have Babette Rothschild in 1784. But in 1784, something else happened. Let's get into a little bit to that.
Yeah, this is where we've got the Adam Weishaupt behind the French Revolution, which was started by Maximilien Robespierre. And this was in a book form, and it was written by one of Weishaupt's associates, which was Xavier Zwack, and sent by courier from Frankfurt to Paris. Now, en route, the courier was actually struck by lightning, and the book detailing the plan discovered by the police and handed over to the Bavarian authorities. The Bavarian government, as a result, got the police to raid Weishaupt's Masonic lodges and the homes of the most influential associates of those. The Bavarian authorities knew that the book was a very real threat by a private group of influential people who planned the use of wars and revolutions to achieve their political ends. And
well, it failed, didn't it?
Well, I mean, the following year, the Bavarian government outlawed the Illuminati, and the year after that, they published the details of the Illuminati in a document entitled The Original Writings of the Order and Sect of the Illuminati, and sent this document to all the heads of church and state throughout Europe. But as we will see, these people ignored the warning.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of people ignoring these warnings we're giving here, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes it's like I'm screaming into an empty chamber here sometimes. But anyway... We get also Meyer Amstel Rothschild moving into Frankfurt. Who does he move in with here, Andrew?
Right. Well, this is it, and this is what we mentioned before. With the Schiff family, and what the listeners need to be aware of here is we're talking about 1785, and the Schiff family, the Rothschild family, lived in the same house in Frankfurt, very large house. And actually, on that very site today is where the European Central Bank sits, on that actual site. But, of course, Schiff is the guy that is behind the Federal Reserve, and also was the guy who gave the $20 million to Lenin to do the Russian Revolution. Obviously, not the same Schiff, but the descendant from this family.
And Warburg, Warburg was in on that deal too, wasn't he?
Yeah, Warburg as well. The Schiff, Warburg, Rothschild, all that connection, yes.
So we get into the 1786, and of course you say that they published the Order and Sect of the Illuminati. 1788, Klansman or Karl Rothschild is born.
Karl.
Okay, now we're into 1789. What do we got here?
We got the French, the Illuminati's plan for the French Revolution. It starts this year, completes in 1793. The result of the French Revolution is they established a new constitution and passed laws that forbade the Roman Church from levying taxes and removed the church's exemption from taxation. And so basically it was, hang on, you're not going to tax the people anymore, we're moving in and we're going to do it.
Well, and interestingly enough, when I talked to Tex Mars the other night, if you listen to that file, I did discuss the finances of the Catholic Church being taken over in the mid-1850s or 60s by Rothschild financiers and bankers. So what we do know is that well over 160 years ago, the Catholic Church gave up it became impotent in point of fact, and gave over its independence financially to the Rothschilds, did it not?
Oh, absolutely, and I think it may have even been earlier than that, because we talked about in the last file, I think around 1820 or so, we had one of the popes then allowing the Rothschild to kiss his ring rather than his toe, and there was certainly some control going on there and some moving of money around that time.
Yeah. 1791, the famous quote comes through, doesn't it? Go ahead with that.
Well, in 1790, this is the quote that the listeners will be familiar with, which is Mayor Amschel Rothschild stating, "Let me issue and control the nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws."
There you go. Now, 1791, somebody in America who still holds some respectability within the Founding Fathers' list of people, who in fact is just an oozing sore of a human being, working for these criminals. Who is that person?
That is Alexander Hamilton Darrell, who basically was the Rothschild's agent in George Washington's cabinet and set up central bank in the United States called the First Bank of the United States that had a 20-year charter. And within the first 5 years of the life of this central bank, the American government will borrow $8,200,000 from it. Prices in the country will increase by 72%. And in relation to this excessive borrowing and inflation, Thomas Jefferson, who was then Secretary of State, would say, "I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution taking from the federal government their power of borrowing, i.e. not allowing the government to borrow money." Yeah. And the interesting thing here is we've just said 1 year before, Mayor Amschel Rothschild saying, "Let me issue and control the nation's money and I care not who writes the laws." Well, the following year, he gets control of the American economy.
Yeah. And of course, everyone in that day knew America was the new El Dorado, and it was going to be a huge windfall for everybody involved, so they wanted full control of it, and of course, taking control of the money issuance was the way to do that. We get into 1792, Amstel children, Jacob James Meyer Rothschild is born, Amstel Meyer Rothschild marries Ava Hanu. Now let's go on to 1798. What do we have here?
Well, we have a guy called John Robison, which he publishes a book entitled Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe, carried on in the secret meetings of Freemasons, Illuminati, and Reading Societies. And this guy was a professor at the University of Edinburgh, regarded as one of the leading intellects of his time. And in 1783, he was elected General Secretary of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And basically, this book gives the details of the whole Rothschild Illuminati plot. And in the book, he tells about how he'd been a high degree Mason in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and had been invited by Adam Weishaupt to Europe, where he was given a revised copy of the Weishaupt conspiracy. He pretended to go along with it, but didn't agree with it, and so published this book to expose it. The book included details of the Bavarian government's investigation into the Illuminati and was updated with the information regarding the French Revolution.
Wow. Okay, and we got David Papin. See, this is interesting because everyone who's looked into this from the American side knows that our universities were completely usurped many years ago, and the Jews are always claiming that they were kept out of top university, but in fact, the flow of information about this crime gang was never introduced to the learning process. So they remained hidden this whole time because these people did control all of the major institutions of learning. And so what do we got here with this guy, David Papin?
Well, what he does here is he's lecturing the graduating class on the influence Illuminism is having on American politics and religion.
Yeah.
So he's sort of getting it over to these people. And of course, I think that we can see in America that we had these wealthy families from going back a very long time. And I think that here, whereas if you like in Europe and what have you, they all went back to like royalty, as it were. In America, it was supposed to be a land where people were going over to kind of start again. And you still had all this money going over there.
Well,
I believe they got ensconced from a very early point in America.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing in 1800. Now, hard to know whether Napoleon was with or against or whatever. I've always found him to be, when somebody's referred to as a Bonapartist, what they are basically is somebody who goes against everybody else who supported him early on. Now, Napoleon actually says something in 1800 that is rather interesting, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's talking about money, and he's looking at making France free of debt, and he says, "The hand that gives is among the hand that takes. Money has no motherland, financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain."
Now, gain can be described in a lot of ways. If you've got a stable currency, which none of us have anymore, gain can be decided by increasing your balance sheet. What the gain today, what everyone needs to understand, gain today is decided by power and control. Now, what I mean by power and control, ladies and gentlemen, is ownership of road systems, ownership of mining interests, ownership of wood and raw material of mining, ownership of monthly payments to gas companies and electric bills. This is where the real value is. Money is today with the fiat system, you don't gauge someone's real power and influence by money. You do it by what they control. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely, Dale.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, people think that you're going to gauge someone's influence by how many billions they have, but the fact is, what do they own, and who has to pay this guy every month for their gas in their car or in their home or whatever? Now let's go here. This one's interesting because I think it might have something to do with the school that I went to here. Solomon Meyer Rothschild marries Carolyn Stern. Now Stern is spelled S-T-E-R-N. The Stern School of Business at New York University is considered the number two or number three finance school in the world.
Right.
And it's the same Stern family.
Right, I see.
And so what we see here is even at one of the world's greatest business schools, which great, I can also mean ignobly great, is the name Stern, but what we find is Rothschild is behind that as well, interestingly enough. So now we get into 1806. Napoleon states that it is his objective to remove the House of Hesse-Kessel, which is the one that he ripped off, did he not?
Yeah, this is what we discussed earlier about the money. When Prince William flees from Napoleon gives the $3 million he has at that time to Myram Shah Rothschild for safekeeping, that Myram Shah Rothschild subsequently gives to Nathan, who invests in the East India Company.
Yeah.
So, but if we go on to 1807, this is an interesting quote. Sorry to jump ahead here, but I wanted to point this out because this is Thomas Jefferson, and if we bear in mind, we just talked about that fourth point in 1776, the fourth point of Weissop's plan to get control of the press.
Yeah.
In this year, Jefferson, who's now president, he said, "Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle. The real extent of this state of misinformation is known only to those who are in situations to confront facts within their knowledge with the lies of the day." So what he's saying here is that he says you can't believe what's in newspaper, folks. I know it's nonsense because I'm in a certain position of power, so I know what's going on, and the newspapers aren't telling you.
Well, you know, if somebody were to take that quote with Thomas Jefferson as the progenitor of that quote and plastered it across newspaper vending machines across America, that might be something very positive. All you'd have to do is walk up with a sticky back to it and stick it on there, ladies and gentlemen. It might be a good idea to let everybody know what our forefathers thought of the press. And maybe people would hesitate to buy the piece of toilet paper out of one of those machines. We got 1808 here. Nathan Meyer Rothschild has his first son born, Lionel Nathan de Rothschild. Now, we get to 1810 here. Sir Francis Baring, let's go into this.
Yeah, him and Abraham Goldsmith, who were basically big bankers.